So exploring the story of disaster government, what does that really mean? And how have national emergencies been used historically and today to manipulate the American public specifically? And it is specifically the American government that's being preserved by COG, the continuity of government idea. And this enjoyed quite a bit of attention during the 1980s, we'll tell you what resulted from that, and what's the residual effect? What is continuity of government mean to us today? Coming up next on Coast to Coast, this is Ian Ponet. So Brian Toohey is available at coasttocoastam.com. Link up to him there. We'll also take your calls coming up next hour. Not ready yet. Continuity of government. That's in the subtitle of disaster government. And so it kind of gets its start after World War II in the Cold War era. There are certain people who are part of the continuity of government and certain people who aren't. But let's talk about the 80s, because I thought that the part about a lot of the orders from President Ronald Reagan around continuity of government, I thought that showed a kind of a unique insight into where we were as a country back then.
Reagan really did ramp the whole program up. It seemed like it had, you know, really peaked originally around Kennedy and the Cuban Missile Crisis, and then kind of ebbed away until Reagan came into office, and he took it to another level and started running all sorts of programs, all sorts of tests to the continuity government, and try to ensure that everything was working as it would necessarily need to when, you know, the Russians and us started a nuclear war with each other, because it seemed to be really on the forefront of Reagan's mind for some reason. And it's kind of interesting that two of the main players in these war games at the time were Donald Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney, who won 9/11 because of the training they had literally back to Reagan era, remembered what to do in the event of a national emergency like that. And those were the two guys who were really directing people to get out of Washington, D.C. into these relocation sites like Mount Weather and Raven Rock, because they knew that if this was really something bigger than it wound up being, that these people needed to get out of Washington, D.C., and they needed to be set up in the right positions to respond.
And so the kind of, like, I mean, you have to go, you can't just say, well, I want to do more of this. In the 80s, you had to have, like, somebody had to be sort of the master planner for what wasn't being done for continuity of government work, what needed to be, you know, how were you going to get it done, and who was going to be in and who was going to be out?
The two people that seemed to be most responsible, and what happened was it seemed like FEMA and the National Security Council kind of merged on this idea, and it put two people in charge. One was Oliver North, of all people, and the other one was the director of FEMA at the time, and the guy by the name of Louis, I think it's pronounced Gefreda. And Gefreda was a really kind of a strange character who wanted to make FEMA basically the lead instrument in instituting martial law in the United States in the event, again, of a national emergency. And FEMA was even smaller then than it is now, so for them to consider even martial law at all seemed absurd, because they're not even a military organization, or not even an armed organization by any stretch of the imagination. But with Oliver North getting involved in the National Security Council, that whole notion started to change, and then they started running what they call these readiness exercises, and the most famous one is this one known as Readiness Exercise 84, or Rex 84, and that's the one where it's simulated rounding up potentially 400,000 illegal immigrants, which many people have taken to believe that they weren't really illegal immigrants they were rounding up, but potentially practicing rounding up American citizens.
Right. And this practice that went on, I mean, they were obviously, again, this was something which was being done by executive order. What are the things were done under Reagan that we may not have thought of as, you know, typical of his presidency, that he did, like every other president before and after him, have done when it comes to using executive orders to get what he wanted?
Well, Reagan, one of the things he instituted is one of the things that I found humorous, actually, was he updated some executive orders that had been rewritten by Nixon that were originally done by Kennedy, and those were the orders that I kind of mentioned before where it gave the government the power to confiscate and ration food, water, and energy and force you to work in certain locations and that sort of thing. He rewrote all those executive orders, and he wrote them in a really kind of vague, obscure way, and he just asked for these different departments and these different secretaries to have, like, adequate responses in place. I mean, he wasn't being as strict as Kennedy was. He was really laying out the law, saying, you need to be ready for nuclear war, you need to prepare to respond, you need to know what's going to happen. He was like, you just need to be adequately prepared for the event of emergency. And he, again, made it very vague so that, like, the head of the Department of Energy was in control of everything energy-related and can basically had a free rein over what right. he deemed necessary at that time.
And as long, and he had to come up with something because the president had told him, come up with something. So
exactly.
That's kind of a fun day in your job when you get to, you know, get around a three martini lunch with the rest of the people in the office and come up with your wish list of the things that you're going to try and do.
Oh, I'm sure. I mean, and they had all these weird plans in place. I mean, one of the things that, you know, like we talk about relocation sites, they have this other notion beyond continuity government called continuity of operations. And that's kind of a subset of continuity of government, which is the entire federal government. Continuity of operations is just about each individual department. And they have, each one has supposedly three relocation sites, an A site, a B site, and a C site. And it's basically the idea is if the A site gets blown up, for example, then the B site people will take over. And if B site people get blown up, then the C site people will take over. And that's how far they went. And I mean, we're talking every department of the federal government has this sort of continuity of operations program supposedly in place.
Right.
And one of the funniest things to me is it always talks about in these continuity of operation programs is that they just want to make sure that they do the essential functions and get the essential functions taken care of. And I think, well, shouldn't really technically everything they do be an essential function?
Right.
There's that many unessential functions that they do that they have to tell people, just make sure you know how to do the essential functions. I mean, that's bureaucracy in action, apparently.
I was thinking of your book when I was watching Live Free or Die Hard the other day, because they were showing it on whatever. And that's the Die Hard movie, which they talk about what's called the fire sale. Right, which is the theory that you could come in and you could you could shut down the whole government, and that if you switched off power in certain places, and that you could essentially take control of the entire U.S. government fairly painlessly, just using cyber terrorism. Right,
yeah.
And I thought what was interesting is that in the movie. That they were showing that there were still certain amounts of these redundant systems that seemed pretty easy to pop into place, like, you know, trailers with these command centers, with these highly, you know, electronic command centers that were all yet, you know, they popped a generator and suddenly they were back online again. And I'm thinking to myself, God, I hope that's true. Somehow, I imagine much more like a trailer like you would see in a used car lot. Like it would just be a place to get out of the rain. Not really that technically savvy. And I hope I'm wrong on that. But so when you talk about sites A, B, C, and D, that gives me hope that maybe we've got a little bit more going for us than just, you know, a microwave and a bun coffee maker for some of these agency department heads.
Well, I hope you're right, too. I mean, it's kind of two different things on this. One is I relay in the book, which I actually saw on, I think it was a History Channel program, where when 9/11 occurred, Laura Bush's chief of staff organized basically all the White House staff. And despite all this continuity government planning that dates back to World War II and all the billions of dollars spent and the relocation sites that were built and all this planning and running tests and evacuation plans and evacuation routes, Laura Bush's chief of staff gathered everyone in the White House and literally said, run for your lives.
Not really.
No, yeah, that's what she said on the program. I quoted directly from the book. She basically told them, run for your lives.
Run for your lives.
But at the same time, these relocation sites are literally underground cities.
Yeah.
You know, some people talking about them, and not many people do talk about them. And that's, you know, people say you can't keep secrets and you can't keep things under wraps. Well, people have built massive underground relocation sites that literally have 3 or 4 story buildings inside them, and nobody's talking about what goes on there. Nobody's talking about who's staffed there, how many people are staffed there, what they have, but they literally have their own, you know, energy generators. They have their own water supplies. They have room for upwards of maybe 2,000 people to stay for 6 months to a year. I mean, these are well-stocked, large locations, and nobody who built them, nobody who works there talks about them.
You know, and if we don't use them, they'll likely fall into the hands of the mole men. So,
quite possibly.
Last thing we need is to empower King Goddard the Squinty at this point for him to take over all of our secret underground bases, you know?
Well, that's where the whole secret shadow government idea comes from, I believe. And supposedly, like at Mount Weather, there supposedly is an ongoing staff that works and lives kind of underground. Now, again, this is something that hasn't been totally 100% confirmed, but it's pretty well confirmed as being real. And that these people who work there are substitutes, unelected, uneven really appointed substitutes for the heads of the large departments, you know, Department of State, Department of Defense, all those, and that they're addressed as Mr. or Ms. Secretary even when they're down there. But they're not the actual secretaries. They're the replacements should the secretaries get blown up or taken out in whatever event occurs.
Well, maybe they can figure out this whole stupid sequester thing. So, again, we're talking about disaster government, national emergencies, continuity of government, and you. So we've talked about all the different presidents and all of the different programs, some of which that they were seemed to be kind of a reflection of their interests, like, you know, what they were really obsessed over. They used their executive orders to get. Looking over the history of the say, the president, the last 5 or 6 presidents, who do you think has the best understanding of the need for disaster preparedness? Or are they all sort of equally selfish, egocentric dictators in this way?
Well, do you mean for like natural disaster preparedness?
Yeah, just as you see these executive orders and using national emergencies, is there anybody that seemed to be driving it up the middle in a way that didn't seem to be manipulating, you know, current events in order to get what they want?
Not necessarily, because if you look at, you can really look at FEMA's history, which dates back to 1979 and Jimmy Carter, who established FEMA. And FEMA, because it is supposedly the emergency response mechanism for the federal government, has been really misguided in many, many ways. And it's like it never had a good direction, because it came in one sense from civil defense planning in the 1960s, and on the other side, it came from a natural disaster response. And the funding that went to FEMA was supposed to fund both sides of it, and yet whoever was like in power would push it more towards terrorism or push it more towards natural disaster. And it usually was after something bad happened. And that's how it would, the money would be spent. But they never had someone really in charge of FEMA who knew what they were doing. I mean, actually, Obama probably has the best person in charge of FEMA of anybody in history, because what he has is a former fire chief, I think, of Miami. His last name is Fugate, I think, or Fugat. And he actually has some, you know, fire and rescue and emergency response background, where a lot of the guys, like the guy Bush had in charge of it during Hurricane Katrina, his background was running like an Arabian horse association.
Right.
We put in charge of FEMA, and of course, then we saw Hurricane Katrina hit, and FEMA didn't know what to do. Well, the guy in charge didn't know what to do.
They so saved the horses.
Yeah, exactly. But why was it a surprise that the government's response was so haphazard when you have a guy in charge who doesn't know what he's supposed to do in an emergency?
Right. Because it had always been been seen as just being a political appointment, not one that, right? I mean, it was just kind of one of those throwaway agencies that they didn't necessarily really expect to do too much.
To a certain extent, yeah. I mean, they some of the other people, I think, like President Clinton had a guy in there who he kind of refined FEMA to its original idea, was that it was an all-hazard response idea. It was that no matter what the disaster is, and it's true, whether it's a terrorist attack, whether it's a biological, chemical attack, a hurricane, an earthquake, what have you, everybody needs food, water, and shelter. It's pretty basic. And that's how this guy who, I can't remember his name, who was under Clinton, ran it. Was, this is what we need. We just need to help people get there and help people and take care of the problem. But that idea would be lost because after Clinton got out of office, the guy was replaced and that whole idea went out the window again. And that's what a lot of the problem is people get mad, people at Hurricane Katrina and people in Hurricane Sandy and other people affected by the floods in the Midwest and what have you get mad at the federal government because they think FEMA is there to help them. But I think what they fail to recognize, and FEMA even tells people if they go to their website, you need to be prepared for at least 3 days to survive on your own before anybody from the government's going to come and help you.
Yeah, that's a theme that we hit a lot here on Coast to Coast, that it's really, it pays just to be prepared for something like that, whether that's, you know, batteries, a wind-up radio, a way to you know, make potable water, to be able to have some basic foodstuffs to get by, that there's many sponsors that we have here on Coast to Coast that that you don't have to have a month's worth, and you're very likely not going to survive, you know, a nuclear dystopian society based on supplies that are in your basement, but you can get by for a couple of days until help arrives. And that's not a bad thing to be prepared for, you know, and times as many, however many people are in your family too.
No, exactly. But I think FEMA and the Department of Homeland Security, which oversees FEMA, could do a much better job of telling people that. Right. And I think that's one of the things is they spend all this money on making all these different response teams, and there's all kinds of response teams. In fact, one of the things I talk about in the book is how supposedly they already have plans in place to respond to a hurricane, an earthquake, and all these other disasters or terrorist-type attacks, and yet even though they have these plans in place, when you see Hurricane Sandy hit, they're completely clueless as to what to do.
Right.
So
you know,
how good are these plans? And who made them and why?
Again, it comes back to politics, though, too. I think that that's the political piece on some of this. They may have plans that they could implement if there were no political implications for doing so. And I don't know whether that says, well, I don't know whether that's true or not. But we also know that sometimes as soon as enough of the right people pipe up and say, hey, where's the help? Suddenly the help shows up. You know,
true. And it's very good. Yeah, it's a very good political thing to do.
So so just to circle back then to where we started with that, the truth of it is, whereas it would fit nicely into some people's narratives that the like a Republican administration would be less inclined to use executive orders to get what it wants. It would be much more of a strict constructionist when it comes to the Constitution. It wouldn't be looking for cheap excuses to, you know, to go outside of the Constitution to get what it wants. Or the other way to look at that is that Democrats would never use fear to get what they wanted through executive orders. Bottom line is history shows us none of that's true. Everybody just gets what they can, right? And there is there are no white hats or black hats when it comes to executive orders from presidents.
Yeah, that's one of the things I point out in the book is it's both sides.
Yeah. And if you don't know that yet, you're missing part of the beauty of that. Now, I want to go back to, we've been talking a little bit about recent stuff, and I know we're going to spend a lot of time in there when we get to some questions coming up in about 30 minutes. But before we get there, there's a couple of very interesting historical abuses that Brian has hinted at that I want to go back to. We'll start with Korea. And then we'll also, I think, in fairness, too, I want to address Vietnam as well. Disaster government, national emergencies, continuity of government, and you, and you will be welcome to call coming up in about 30 minutes. We'll give you the numbers next hour. Hang on for that, because I'd love to hear what you have to say about it on the way on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Ponet. Hey, listen, we'll get back to disaster government coming up in just a second. National emergencies, continuity of government, and you. I forgot to mention something for those of you, and I do occasionally hear from people who are pipe smokers. I enjoy a bowl now and again, and I wrote a piece that has to do with radio and pipes, and it's coming out in the next edition of Pipes and Tobacco magazine. So I came meaning to go to a newsstand and see whether it's out there yet, or to go to a pipe shop or a cigar shop in my neighborhood. And the last time I went, it wasn't quite out, but I thought I'd heard from Chuck Stanion, who's the editor in chief, and I think it's out now. So if you're inclined to go to a cigar shop, take a look at Pipes and Tobacco magazine. There's a piece in there about microphones and pipes, and I'll just let that hang out there, because it kind of works together once you see the pictures. It's pretty cool. And so's this book, Disaster Government, National Emergencies, Continuity of Government, and You. And let's talk about war and national emergencies coming up next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Ponet. Disaster Government author Brian Toohey will take your calls coming up in just a few minutes. But let's go back to the Korean War, because for a long time, there was a national emergency in regard to North Korea that remained on the books. And yet it was a national emergency that was used to essentially for our involvement from the very beginning on this.
Yeah, the national emergency on Korea, I believe, started in 1950, I want to say. And it actually didn't end until 1976 when the National Emergencies Act ended it. But Korea was, in fact, it wasn't a declared war by Congress. In fact, Congress did absolutely nothing in regards to the Korean War. I mean, it didn't really endorse it. It didn't tell Truman to stop it. It just, Congress basically sat there and let it take place. And it was all done under the guise of a national emergency.
And what we were doing was a police action, right?
Well, I think, I don't know if it was really called a police action, but it was a fear that the situation was a grave threat to America, and I think even Truman said it was a grave threat to the world and the United Nations on top of it, and that the United States had to act in order to, you know, secure the world peace in a way, I guess.
Yeah, I think it was called a police action. At least it was in MASH. So I think that's what Truman originally called it, and that's how they could get away with essentially having it be a non-declared war, that it was a national emergency and we were responding to it as though we were police being called to the scene.
That could very well be, but I think he, in his actual declaration, he talked about it basically trying to stop the spread of communism.
Right.
I think that's what he referred to as. But yeah, I could see it would be the same rationale.
But then once the ball gets rolling again, like we've seen in other patterns, nobody in Congress is willing to do or say something that might be unpopular or might put them on the wrong side of their electorate. So they don't do anything at all. Continue to let it roll on until eventually it plays itself out. And yet then that pattern is repeated with the Vietnam War. Now, where did national emergencies play a part in the development of the Vietnam War, or didn't it?
It did not. That's the odd part, is even though it worked effectively, I guess, if you want to call it that, from a presidential standpoint in the Korean War, Vietnam War was never declared a national emergency, and none of that power was used on Vietnam. Now, similar powers were used by the president on the American populace during that time in terms of kind of martial law,
right,
the Comitatus Act situations, but it wasn't effective really in the country or what created the Vietnam War at all.
Well, see, that's what I was getting at, was that there was a sense of the national emergencies on the college campuses across the country. And I was just watching a clip again of Richard Nixon in a documentary the other day talking about that the problem was not the war that we were fighting. It was the fact that, you know, here were these protesters, and protesters were on the streets and they were trying to take over our country. So I'm surprised that that didn't become that protesting in the streets wasn't counted as a national emergency.
It was very close, though. I mean, they did, on, I believe, two occasions, basically issue kind of like an Insurrection Act proclamation that allowed military troops to actually act as a police force within the United States, which is illegal under the Posse Comitatus Act, which dates back to the Civil War. But I believe they did it after during like riots after Martin Luther King's death, and also I think after the riots after the invasion of Cambodia, which you played the song Ohio, which
right.
Created the Kent State shooting, which killed four students there. Those are basically, you know, the military acting as a police force here in the United States, which is technically illegal.
And yet, these, as you said, you know, there really weren't any major repercussions for that either. We know that Nixon runs into trouble later on. What were some of the other national emergencies, though, that Nixon did declare, or the ways in which he used that while he was in office?
He only declared two. One was because of the U.S. postal strike. The postal workers went on strike, and at a time before email and cell phones and even, I think, UPS and some of the other major shipping companies, the stoppage of postal delivery in the United States was a huge deal. And he declared a national emergency that I believe put the National Guard in charge of postal services for a few days until they negotiated the postal worker strike and got them back in action. And the other national emergency was kind of one that I couldn't quite follow because it was a real kind of legalese type of thing, which dealt with import and export controls here in the United States. So, I mean, they weren't anything necessarily related to violence or civil unrest or Vietnam or anything of that nature. They were two kind of benign ones, really, in all honesty.
The idea of a national emergency when it comes to labor, that had been done many times before, usually during wartime, or at least that was the excuse, right, to keep people from striking or to keep services flowing.
Well, Truman did a lot of that after World War II, not declare national emergencies, but using executive orders to force like certain steel mills and mining operations to work regardless of wages and that sort of thing. He used it kind of as a strike-breaking tool. And oddly enough, they actually got shot down by the Supreme Court. And one of the things that the Truman administration tried to fight against the Supreme Court in this argument was using a national emergency. And it was really strange that the Supreme Court shot down their idea of using an executive order and this kind of national emergency idea on, you know, steel mill workers. But yet, at the same time, they did absolutely nothing about the Korean War. So it's like, it's okay to use an executive order to create a war, but it's not okay to use an executive order to make people, work.
And there was another example, and I dog-eared so many pages in Disaster Government, I'd have to go find it in a break. But where you talk about there would be labor issues that were being resolved, or that they were using executive orders, say, to stop people from patronizing certain businesses or to stop being able to sell something overseas. Was that part of the Enemies Act, the trading with
the Enemies Act, which dates to 1917, I believe. And, yeah, that's one of the tools they use a lot of the times in these national emergencies is trading with the Enemies Act to stop people, for example, like today with terrorism. They still invoke the Trading with the Enemies Act, or there's another variation of it. I forget the name of it, but it basically acts in the same way. It stops people from funding terrorism or funding these places outside of the United States that have been deemed terrorist, and it prevents them from bringing their money here as well, and they'll freeze assets here in the United States.
But this is done by executive order.
Exactly.
Okay. And that after wars, frequently, even when a president like Woodrow Wilson would have expanded his powers in the presidency. At the end of the presidency, they frequently will give back whatever it was that they took. Right. I mean, this has happened a couple of times where a president has famously said, now I made this executive order because I had to. Now we don't have to do it anymore. So now I'm discontinuing the order. But that idea of trading with the enemies, that somehow survived.
Yeah, that one survived. It really goes back to Woodrow Wilson. He, during World War One, he passed a lot of, I shouldn't say laws, but a lot of executive orders that were like, you know, some sedition acts and things of that nature, which prevented people really from using their freedom of speech against World War One in the United States.
I mean, by executive order, didn't he make it illegal to speak against the government?
Yes, right? In a real way he did. He even allowed, you couldn't even write certain things in magazines that were going to be sent across state lines, too.
Yeah, because he used the post office to stop people from distributing those things. It wasn't that he made the publications illegal. He just made it illegal to distribute them through the post office.
Yeah, it was kind of like, you know, making whiskey. It's kind of the same thing. You know, you can't distribute it. But
right.
But yeah, that's what they did. And he did at the end of World War One, when he left office, rescind all of those. Thank God.
Mm-hmm.
But the Trading with the Enemies Act is one that never was rescinded, but I think that because it was an act of Congress, it wasn't necessarily something that Wilson did on his own. But still, that survives, you know, nearly 100 years later, and it's still used 100 years later for the exact same purposes.
Well, wasn't that an example, or maybe I'm wrong, but I know there were other examples where the president would do something by executive order, and then Congress would follow up later on and undergird it. But if the president hadn't have done it, they wouldn't have, Congress wouldn't have done it. The president did it, made it popular, made it seem like it was necessary. And so Congress harumphed its way into a vote so that they didn't look like Nimrods.
And they did that many times. And it again dates back to Lincoln's era, because that's where kind of the tradition started, for better or for worse. Lincoln did a lot of things. And it was interesting. Lincoln could have made Congress reconvene much earlier than he did, after the outbreak of the Civil War, to get some of these things rolling, to get the army, you know, together and other funding issues, but he didn't. Instead, he just physically did it through his own executive orders. Then, like you said, later on, Congress came along and said, well, it's kind of hard to stop it now. All this stuff is in motion, so I guess, okay, it passes.
Mm-hmm.
And again, that was a precedent that continued onwards, where it happened in World War One, it happened in World War Two, where the president would just do something because he felt like doing it, and Congress would go, well, yeah, I guess, okay, fine.
Yeah. But this is what builds up the power then of the executive branch under these disaster government models, is that, you know, nobody wants to be perceived as going against the leader. And so the leader is doing something right, and the people seem to be buying into it, then they're going to buy into it too. But that's not how our government is set up. I mean, that's not what it's supposed to be like. So that's part of why this is such an important book for people to consider. It's not full of like a bunch of, you aren't just saber rattling here. I mean, you're really going through, you know, administration by administration, and you're showing how it is that these government powers were expanded by sheer will, and then nobody challenged him on it. So today, this is how we've got it. Now, what do you think could happen realistically when you look forward, knowing what, say, President Obama has as part of the series of executive orders or some of the assumed powers? What do you really think an American president could get away with if he or she were so inclined?
Well, I think if you look at the historical record that I tried to provide in this book, and like you said, that's one of the things I try to hammer home too, is that none of this is make-believe stuff. I mean, I'm giving you the actual physical documents where, even if I only give you a snippet of it, you can go look it up and see.
Oh, but most of the time you don't. You print out, like, you go through long quotes. Some of them, like, Brian, my God, there's like two pages of this quote.
I probably should have edited it down, but I didn't want to be accused of cherry-picking.
No, I get that.
So, you know, you have to read it, and you can understand it, and you realize this is what the government is really doing and what it's really capable of doing, and it should kind of shock some people when they read this stuff, because it shocked me. I mean, that's kind of why I wrote the book, is because I kind of did this as a hobby, and then all of a sudden I realized, holy cow, this isn't make believe. This is real, and nobody's written a book like this. I guess I'm going to do it.
I guess I have to. So
yeah,
what would be, what could a president do? Yeah.
That's the thing, is really, you know, given a bad situation, the president has the power to make it a whole lot worse for the citizens of the United States. I mean, he can really, really just trample upon the Constitution because of something. He declares a national emergency. He then can determine how best to respond to this national emergency, and then he can institute all of these. There's like literally 22, I believe, standby, what they call standby executive orders that a president could sign into action, and these things do the, you know, worst of the worst. It can suspend due process. It can suspend habeas corpus. And he can basically tell the FBI to go round up a whole mess of dissenters, whether or not they've broken any sort of law, because they could be problematic for the country.
Is there still, are there still executive orders that would allow a president to do what Woodrow Wilson did, what Abraham Lincoln did, which is shut down the voice of opposition in media?
Oh, yes, definitely. I mean, there are, one of the things he can do is he can establish, you know, a code of censorship for definitely. And he can take over the airwaves. I mean, and again, it's kind of a double-edged thing, because people get all freaked out. Like, we had that test, I think, of the National Emergency Broadcast System that was supposedly was going to shut down every, you know, TV, radio, and everything to broadcast an emergency signal. Now, like, I live in the Midwest. You know, if a tornado comes and the tornado siren sounds, you know, they can interrupt whatever I'm watching on TV and say, hey, dummy, there's a tornado coming.
Right.
And that's not all bad. You know, that's a good thing that came out of this, you know, the ability of the government to take over the airwaves, because they can warn you, oh, there's a chemical spill. Oh, you know, something's occurring. You need to be alerted to it. You need to react to it because it's for your own safety. But it can go that extra step where technically the president could take over the airwaves and never relinquish them.
Right.
Broadcast propaganda 24/7. And, you know, that's the way it is because he has that power. And that's how scary it can be.
I'd be curious to see whether or not there, I mean, that's the reason I asked the question the way I did, was I wanted to hear what you had to say about it. I wonder whether, though, there is a greater awareness now of what these powers are, and therefore, unlike, say, under Woodrow Wilson, or unlike, say, during even the Korean War, which was coming right after World War II and right after all these concerns about the Cold War, et cetera, that I wonder whether there would just be so much pushback now that the president, no president could control the internet, or no president could ultimately control any of the media, because it's so decentralized. You couldn't just go in and say, we're going to take over these four networks and own the media, because they just doesn't exist anymore. And with all of the cellular phone technology and all of, you know what I mean by that, all the bit streaming and other things, whether it's even possible for a president to be able to do what they did so easily 100 years ago.
I think they can. That's what kind of freaks me out. I mean, when you think about media, there's really, what, I think 5 or 6 corporations that control all the media. I mean, the vast majority of the media, I should say. And I think, you know, the NSA and the National Reconnaissance Office and some of those other, you know, alphabet soup agencies that are out there, I think they have the very real possibility of shutting everything down if they want to. I think they can clamp down very quickly and very easily if they want to. Again, the question is, will they? Will they agree with what some, you know, potentially tyrannical president wants to do, given the right set of circumstances? That's the bigger question.
Okay. Well, I think the good news is, just to see you on, there are a lot more than 5 or 6 even large size media companies out there. And there's enough of them that I think it would keep the president from being able, from any president, to get a stranglehold on the media. But I think you'll accept also that we have so many more opportunities for people to reach out without going through media, even, that I think that would be tricky. But still, it's a scary enough thought. Disaster government, national emergencies, continuity of government, and you. We have an hour of your calls and Brian Toohey coming up next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett.